Dave Max Cork History Matters, brought to you by Red FM.
Aidan O'Sullivan, thanks for joining me. You are the great nephew, or
grand nephew
of Michael Collins. Yeah. Your grandmother was his eldest sister.
Yeah, that's correct. I would have learned about Michael Collins from my mother, principally, and also from my grandaunt Hanny, who was Michael Collins' sister. We lived with in London up until the 1916 Rising. Michael went to London as a young boy of 15.
Well, yeah, let me ask. So, Lisaverd, because, I mean, we're here in Cork, so we can get a bit more exact than other people call him like a Clonakilty man or whatever. But Lisaverd is the area, is it? Or Woodfield was the farm, is it?
Woodfield was the townland.
The
townland where the farm was.
Okay. And that's nearest to Lisaverd in West Cork, is it?
It's close to Roscarbery, halfway between Roscarbery and Clonakilty.
Mm. Not too far away from where Tom Barry was from. Not too far away from, well, O'Donovan Ross, I think, was a Rossmore man originally.
Yeah, that's right. O'Donovan Ross would have been one of the people that Michael Collins would have idolised as a child growing up.
Mm. And he was kind of like a physical force Republican and an unrepentant physical force Republican, founded the Phoenix magazine in Skibbereen. He has memories of the famine. He would have seen his family and his neighbours and his friends suffering from the famine and would have left a mark on him. And because that's kind of what I'm a little bit interested in.
Yeah.
I heard you talk elsewhere of Collins leaving for London at 15, that he was never going to get the farm. So if you're not going to get the farm, what options have you? I mean, maybe the priesthood.
Yeah, which he didn't go for, by the way. No. But he went to London and he worked in the post office there. And he also, he was, I don't want to say he was under the thumb of his sister, but his sister was, Hanny was quite a few years older than him. And she was another big sister of his. But she encouraged him to further his education.
And so it's no surprise that if he was a smart boy, but how many brothers and sisters were there, do you know?
He had another two brothers. He had a brother Johnny, and a brother Pat, who left Ireland, I think, before, I'm not quite sure. I think he left Ireland before the Troubles, and he ended up being a captain in the police force in Chicago. And this weekend we're having a reunion, and it's sad for me insofar as we searched high and low to find relatives of Pat. And I know some of them appeared about 10 years, but we couldn't find any. That was disappointing for us.
Okay, yeah. So who was the eldest brother that got the farm then?
That was John.
That was John.
Who was known as Johnny.
Mm-hmm. And a number of sisters. So two brothers and a number of sisters.
Yeah, that's right. He had a sister, Mary, who was my grandmother. He had a sister, Margaret. He had a sister, Hanny. He had a sister, Lena, who actually became a nun. I think it was a Mercy nun. And I think she was in the UK. And he also had a sister, Katie, who married a farmer in Bohola in Mayo. And whose brother, and her brother-in-law, Katie's brother-in-law, won 3 gold medals for America in the Olympics.
Goodness me.
Back in, I think I not got to whatever year it was, 1907, 1900, or around then. Sometime.
Early days of the Olympics.
Early days of the Olympics. And I suppose the story that was related to me from my mother is that there was a young man in the Bohola district, went for the priesthood, and she had the 3 gold medals melted down to make a chalice for him. So. No, that's the story I have.
Whether
and validated for you,
yeah,
but anyway,
yeah.
That's it.
Well, it's a good one. So that's a number of two brothers, one who might have ended up in the police force in Chicago, or did.
Did, yes.
Did end up in the police force in Chicago, but you've slightly lost trail with that side of the family. Johnny, who inherited the farm, a number of sisters, including your grandmother. So that's a big family, but that's probably not that unusual. His dad obviously was the farmer. Was it his family's land for...
It went back over a number of generations, and I think the farm increased in size from time to time.
Yeah. And was he John? They often name the eldest child after. Was he a John? Was he?
I'm not quite sure about that one. Mm. But what I would say to you is that in a number of the books I've read, in particular Tim Pat Coogan's book on Michael Collins, he has a lot of historical references to back pre-famine times and about the hardship that the basically that the farming community had all around that time, and you know, it's very interesting. I think it's from there, and as you've mentioned to me about Donovan Rossa, that he you know, he became interested in
well, it would leave a mark, and you wouldn't it.
It did.
You know, because people look at, you know, and you look at the historical sweep of Ireland's history, and you look at that point and you kind of go, look, we're never going to get a fair crack of the whip here. No. You know, when you look and see how the ordinary people of Ireland were treated through that period by, you know, we were an integral part of the empire. We were an integral part of the United Kingdom at that point. The Act of Union had occurred 40, 50 years previously, yeah, in 1801. Yeah. And yet this was allowed to happen to a whole section of society. But, you could argue, I don't know, it's maybe unfair to say the most Irish of the Irish, but the ordinary Irish Gaelic Catholic peasant were the ones who suffered through that whole period, and arguably it leaves a mark and a stain and a suggestion that, like, we're never going to get a fair crack of the whip. No. There's only one way to solve this, and that's by taking matters into our, not even taking matters into our own hand, but I suppose the phrase they use these days is sovereignty, is restoring sovereignty to the people of the place. And I think that was the goal and the dream and the desire, and West Cork was a hotbed of it, O'Donovan Rossa being just one of many names.
It was, but there was also some reports I've read on Michael Collins around, particularly when he came back at Christmas 1916 after being interned in Frongook, is that I don't think some of the local farmers were too happy,
right,
with him and what he was doing, that he might have been considered a bit of an upstart,
yes,
in the area,
yes,
but that's only from historical reports I've written.
And you could have, you know, I'm sure there'd be different views of people saying, listen, you're causing trouble and leave it alone, you're going to draw heat on us round here, and listen, we're doing well enough and leave us alone, kind of thing. And
that was a part of it, I think.
And it wasn't necessarily sectarian, as we know. Sam Maguire, a West Cork man, a Protestant, who he and Liam McCarthy, I believe, swore Michael Collins into the IRB in London.
That's correct, yeah. I think it was 1909. It was only something I read there in one of the history books that they swore him in. But he got actively involved then.
Yeah,
in the Geraldine.
Liam McCarthy's parents were Ballygarvan, and they left around famine time as well, and you'd imagine as a result of hardship. So, I mean, it's hardwired in into that whole thing. So he leaves for opportunities. He's encouraged by his sister. She's obviously spotted that he's a smart...
I wouldn't say he left for opportunities. Opportunity wouldn't be the word I'd say. Okay. He left because he had to go.
Oh.
You know, there was nothing for him in Ireland at the time.
Yes.
And he went.
At 15.
And
probably at 15, not. 15. It seems young now.
Yeah, well, he did. I'm told that, I understand he did sort of 7 years in national school, and then he did the post office exams. And he.
And Sam Maguire, I think, ran the post office in London, wasn't he? He was the main man. Yeah. Or was it McCarthy? It was one of them.
It
was McCarthy, and that's how Maguire got the job over there, and Collins, too. Yeah. So there was a Cork mafia going on over there, was there?
His aunt or his sister, Hanny, I think, worked in the post office as well there. So I think she brought him in. She brought him in
but
there.
But with that Irish way, I mean, we know it. If you go over to America and you know someone, and they'll, you know, they know someone and they look after you. There was obviously a little bit of a network, or of, you know, if you head over to London and there's we can get you going.
Yeah.
So he's over. He's young, and he's influenced by presumably a revolutionary fervour that's going on at the time within the Irish community.
And as I said, he joined the IRB, and he was also involved in the Geraldines Gaelic club there. I don't think, in some of the reports of the Geraldines, they found it difficult to field the team a lot of the time. But what did I say?
Do we know, was he a player? Or was he a...
He played, but I think he was one of the main guys behind fundraising and things. And the reports of him, you know, being on to people, looking for them to pay their subs.
The subs.
And getting into... You know, getting into hot water for doing that, but but I think I think he's a very intelligent young man, and he went to King's College in London, and he studied. I know he studied mathematics, law, commercial law, I think it was, and you know, and accountancy, of course, and I think that you know, when after the Rising and on the foundation of the state, when he became Minister for Finance and set about organising the first loan, I think that was quite significant for him.
Yeah. He died at 31 in 1922. So my math on that is that he was born in 1891, thereabouts.
1890.
So it's 1905 when he's in London.
1905.
You know, it's before the First World War, obviously. I'm trying to think of kind of like what might life have been like then for him. I suppose there's trams buzzing all around the place.
Yeah,
air of industry and hustle and bustle, and would have been very different from West Cork, I'd imagine.
I think it would have been, but I think he adapted well to it, you know. And I think that when he got into his late teens, early 20s, he, you know, that was in his formative years, he was in London.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think
not
maybe...
Not a bad place to be as a young
not
man.
A bad, but, you know, I think particularly for young people, I think that Michael Collins was a very, very young man.
Mm.
And people know today, everybody says he would have, should have, could have done this and that. Mm. He was a very young man.
Mm.
And what he did, you know, I think it's most significant for this country, you know.
Oh, there's no question.
And it's regrettable, probably.
Oh,
it's the most regrettable part of it in all he did to, he did in the War of Independence, that would be another Irishman most likely shot him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is most regrettable.
Yes. And do you, what's your feeling on, I mean, we're jumping straight into that. We'll come back again to young Michael Collins as a man, if you don't mind, and build him up a bit more. But straight to the ambush. I mean, you know, it's funny as you get older, as I get older, and you read other things and you kind of go, wow, oh, right, that was actually happening at the same time as this, that you connect things together that you maybe didn't know and join the bits together. And sorry, just on your point, we were robbed of so many amazing young Irish men.
Absolutely.
As a result of the Civil War and the War of Independence. The Civil War itself, never mind the War of Independence.
Yeah.
Even in the Rising itself, like the James Connollys, the vision that they had was quite radical and revolutionary, and arguably the Free State that came into being had lost that revolutionary radical edge to it. It might have been interesting to see what kind of an Ireland might have emerged if the likes of James Connolly and even
Absolutely.
The Padraig Pearces of the world had been there to help shape it,
yeah.
as opposed to having sort of ignited the spark that led to it.
Yeah.
And certainly the likes of Collins and many others. I mean, you know, what is it? Is it Harry Boland was great friends with Michael? Was he his best man? And
I think they were best men, you know, but...
And then ended up on the opposing sides and
all I can say, it's all very sad. They're all fine men.
Mm. But on that, so, you know, because there had been an amphibious landing in Cork. The IRA had held Cork City for a number of months. Was it General Emmett? I can't remember the name of who it was, landed the troops down in Passage West and they fought their way into the city. Yep, no, there's a it's called The Invasion of Cork.
Yeah.
John Borgonovo, who's a UCC professor, has written this little book on it and it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Drove them out through Rochestown. So then they abandoned the city at that point and the IRA retreated back into West Cork, into their, you know, their stronghold as such. And not long after, within weeks, Collins did a bit of a tour. So I've been doing these history podcasts with Gabriel Doherty of UCC historian. And I asked him, I said, was there a little bit of hubris in Collins, you know, heading down into West Cork and touring around, knowing full well that the city had just been cleared of the Republican forces and they were all in and around there? And he was like, well, look, no, there was a bit of sort of PR to it, in that he was inspecting his troops and he's inspecting the barracks. And, you know, it was a show of force to some degree that the Free State are in charge here. And then on the way back, Béal na Bláth, they're ambushed late in the day. The party had lain there in wait for nearly 24 hours seemingly and were about to leave, thinking that the party weren't going to come that way. And and even in that, it was, you know, 20-30 minutes after the engagement, you know, it was all over. The ambush party were retreating and Collins stood up to have a look around, and one lad seemingly took one last pot shot, because it was from a distance. It was a bit of a lucky shot seemingly. What's the family feeling about that? Like, was it an assassination? Certainly the party were being ambushed. Were they trying to kill Collins? Were they trying to, do you think it was...
You know, it's great for that historian whose name is it, John. Everybody's got a view on this.
Yes.
Everybody's got a view. But it's my firm belief that Michael Collins, yes, he may have been doing a tour and inspection, but he also wanted to end the Civil War. And this 100 years may not have proved that, but it may take another 100 years to prove that. But he wanted an end to the Civil War. And that is my own belief. And there's very little more. I can say.
Oh, I'd say it broke his heart that it occurred in the first place. Aidan,
because at the time, 2 weeks before the end of the Civil War, he was trying to create bridges with Northern Ireland, so that we could basically, I think his belief would have been, we would have had a united Ireland. I know that he met Craig at the time, and it is historically reported that he was seeking Craig to allow Catholics work in Harland and Wolfe, and the quid pro quo for that is that more dairy produce from Northern Ireland would be sold to the south, but that never happened. Collins died, and the north and the south drifted further apart again.
I would say the Civil War broke his heart. He was the one, I think, had to instigate. I mean, well, he was the Minister for Finance. He was involved in many. I don't know how many meetings he might have had over a given day. Have you had a look at his diaries? I mean, the family were in possession of the diaries that you've now gifted to the state.
I haven't seen his diaries yet, but I know he did a hell of a lot, and he got up early and he worked late. That's all I know from the reports I have.
Yeah, and probably struggled with the workload. You know, for all my interest in history and all the historical sites I've visited in Cork, I've not gone to Collins House. What's in Clonakilty? There's a museum to.
There's two museums near Clonakilty. There's one on the Cork side of Clonakilty, run by Mr. Crowley, and then there's another museum on the main square in Clonakilty. Mm. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, that's what I'm familiar. And as for Woodfield, is the farm in still in existence? Is his old home still there?
Well, his old home was burned by the Black and Tans.
Wow.
In 1921, as a reprisal for, I think, around the time of the burning of Cork. And all that's there really are the foundations of his old home. But the shed at the back of the farm where he was actually born, has been actually done up by the Board of Works. And it's a nice place. It's a nice place to visit. But that's all that remains. I think it's significant that my own grandmother, who lived in Mount Nebo off Blarney Street, that when the Black and Tans burned Woodfield, that the three children there had nowhere to go. There's a lot written about the war, about our Civil War and about this, but there were a lot of victims of the Civil War. But those three children, plus my grandmother's nine children, all had to live in one house off Blarney Street. I think the three children had to live there for a while. I don't know how long, but there were tough times for them.
So would Collins's dad have passed at this point?
Yeah, contrary to what some of the history books say about him being that Michael Collins came to Cork to discuss where monies were being siphoned off. Very difficult because my grandfather, Patrick Paul, died in 1919, about 3 years before Michael Collins was shot.
There was a suggestion that Collins, your grandmother, told Michael that she knew from the husband that money was being siphoned to the Republicans, and he said he'd go investigate. But as you've mentioned there,
grandfather
was gone, his father was gone.
I always believe paper never defies ink anyway. People, and also I think in all of this, look, people believe what they want to believe, but the facts, there are facts there as well, and hopefully they'll all come out in time.
What was Collins's mother's surname? What family was she?
She was married to a gentleman by the name of Patrick Paul. And she's Collins Pole as such, you know.
So, and did she keep the two? She kept the.
She did. Her the next generation Poles kept it anyway. She was Mary Collins anyway.
Yes, gotcha. So his father had passed in 1919. So John has the farm. John's burned out of the farm. John has three kids, or Johnny, as you mentioned earlier, and they have to move into the house in Blarney Street with the nine other children
off
Blarney Street, and about 12 kids and three, four adults.
Yeah, and.
And lose the farm? Or
no, he kept the farm.
He continues to farm it.
They kept the farm. from what I've read, I think the farm was sold in the 20s, a few years later. Mm. But no, there were tough times.
Mm. Oh, I wouldn't doubt it.
No, because I think that after Collins was shot, the reports that the new government, they had given a pension to Arthur Griffith's family, mm-hmm. because Arthur Griffith died 10 days before Michael Collins. But my grandmother was offered a pension, but she refused it, and she said she would actually get along and work things out for herself. So she reared really her 9 children.
Goodness me.
Because Mike, I'd say Mike would have been helping her out before he was shot.
Yes.
But these are the things.
Yes.
These are the things which history
doesn't record.
Doesn't record.
Yeah. Wow. So 1905 is when he goes to London, roughly, and then, you know, so 1905. So he's 25 then when 1916 happens. 25, 26, and he's still in London at that point, is he? Does he spend a decade over there?
He stays there until 19. He came back in 1916, just before the rising in 1916.
And was he here in Cork then?
No, he was in Dublin all the time.
Dublin. And was he involved in the rising?
He was in the GPO.
He was in the GPO.
No. I think growing up, the history books did not write. He seemed to have been very little about Michael Collins in the history books. I don't know why.
Around that period, was it?
Well, no, but in the 1960s, 1950s, 60s and 70s.
Oh, right, sure.
So, you know, Michael Collins was in the GPO. He was an aide-de-camp to Joseph Plunkett, as far as I know. And after the rising, went to prison in Frongoch in Wales. I think Frongoch was just a making up old distillery that they turned into a prison camp. And it wasn't very, the conditions there were awful. Mm. And around Christmas 1916, they were all released. I think it might have been on Christmas Eve, but I think he went straight back to Dublin, and that's where he spent, you know, that's where he spent the time then. I think the great thing about Frongoch, it was a nursery for creating the environment for Republic.
The organisation. Is there any sense of maybe who, you know, so if he's an aide-de-camp to Joseph Plunkett in the GPO, or, but he obviously, you know, it's clearly smart, charismatic, impressive, intelligent, fun man, a man that would be unlikely to not get noticed for the skills that he possessed. But do we know who might have sort of spotted him and brought him along and elevated him through the ranks of the organisation? Or perhaps he did it of his own sheer sort of force of nature himself.
Yeah. Well, all I've read is they say that he seemed to have impressed everybody when he was in Frongoch with his organisation skills. Mm. And, you know, he seemed to have been a natural leader coming to the fore at that stage.
Well, he was obviously good with numbers, and he had probably all the organisational skills from the post office. Mm. So, yeah, he was probably a very useful man. Mm. So what do we know then? And he become, like, you know, through the War of Independence, that, you know, it was, you know, Michael Collins ran it is loosely the story that people...
Yeah, I think he had learned one thing more than anything else. I'll use a term, that a closed mouth catches no flies. And that basically one of the main problems, I think, in history was informers. So I think the people who were around him, it was on a need to know basis. And even with that, he was very lucky to escape on many occasions when he was being pursued by both the British forces and, mainly the British forces in Dublin and the Secret Service in Dublin, or the Cairo Gang, to be precise.
And the RIC, I guess. The stories of him are they're almost that he's a little cavalier in his, you know, that it's almost, who is it you're looking for? Oh, Collins. Oh, you'll have to catch that fella sometime. Or, you know, that he sort of played up to the whole kind of thing that they didn't know who he was, and that he'd almost hide in plain sight. But obviously he was smart enough to not get caught. But what was his actual title? Are you you aware of through that period? Like, what was his sort of technical role in the Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I'm not sure myself either. But he, you know, did he run the sort of the secret army of the IRA? I guess he did. But he's 29, 30 in that War of Independence. It's at a good period and point in his life, I guess, in that regard. What I remarked on when we were chatting about this through the various podcasts that I've recorded on these subjects is that they were going through a pandemic at the time as well.
There were, yeah, the flu in 1918.
Known as the Spanish flu.
The Spanish flu, yeah. Which I know a few, it actually took the, it took my, his sister or Katie's brother-in-law, who was the Olympian, he died in the Spanish flu.
Wow.
I think that's the year he died.
I could be open to correction on this, but seemingly the Spanish flu actually affected younger people worse than it affected older people.
Yeah, and he was very young. He was very young. You know?
Yeah. And there was some suggestion that whatever it was, that perhaps older generations had had some encountering with it along the way, that they'd had some level of immunity, whereas young people didn't. So it's just amazing to think that through that whole period of the War of Independence, there was actually wave after wave of a global pandemic. And, you know, 100 years on, there we were with some knowledge of what that can be like.
Because somebody said to me there about what would Collins think of Ireland today, you know, and I don't know, he was shot in. Mm. He was shot in 1922, but I suppose it's a fair country that we're just coming out of a pandemic where when you hear of the massive numbers in other countries of people who died and our near neighbours as well, I think there's about 5,000 recorded cases of people who died during the pandemic. And that's a, I think we should be proud of how we managed it.
Well, that's what I said. I hope he'd be proud of the country that we have become, and probably saddened that we still haven't managed to constitute the island collectively in some fashion. I think that's the final step that I hope we take at some point. That it's a small island, you know, where we 6 million plus people, maybe 7 million all in, and if we can't work out a way to agree amongst ourselves how to live on the island together as one place,
I think economic unity is where what we need. We need to actually become closer and closer with the rest of the country as regards being a small, we're a small unit at the end of the day.
What we haven't said, Aidan, in this conversation, people could be listening to this at any point, but you and I are speaking just days in advance of the 100th anniversary of Michael Collins' assassination, or the ambush that killed Michael Collins in Béal na Bláth. The date would be August 22nd, 1922. So we're just, it's the 19th of August, 2022, as we discuss here now. And there's you are very involved in a whole series of conversations. And again, I'm very grateful to you. Tell me about the oration. Will you be there this Sunday? Do you go over the years?
I've been there in a number. I would say I'd be lying to you to say that I go there every year. I go there from time to time. Mm. I was there for when Mary Robinson spoke there. And I hope the weather's better today than it was the day she spoke. It was very, very wet, I remember. And I was there on the days the various Taoiseach spoke there, and I was there the day Brian Lenihan spoke there.
As I was myself, yes.
Yeah, and I think was it
that was that was 2010.
2010.
A few short weeks before he passed, I believe.
Yeah, and you know,
The first Fianna Fáil, or first Fianna Fáil minister, at least, and this weekend will mark the first Fianna Fáil Taoiseach to speak there jointly with the Fine Gael leader.
You know, I think myself, without, I'm not going to get political, but I think between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil over the 100 years since Michael Collins was shot, there are a lot of bumps along the road. But they've built a very good country. If we go as Irish people, as young, particularly young people go abroad and they're welcomed. They're welcomed because they're Irish. And I think that tells a lot for the country that has been created over the last 100 years.
Yep, I wouldn't disagree with you. Let me ask you about some of the events that are happening. His final days in the city were in the Imperial Hotel.
That's correct.
Was it room 115 or
room 115? Yeah, and I was. How all this came about was, I came back from a holiday late last year, and a niece of mine and a cousin of mine asked me would I join them, And we would try and get all as many of the family together as possible in Cork for this weekend. So there's about 215 of us getting together in Cork.
Goodness.
On Saturday evening. And also, we have a number of events. We will lay a wreath at his bust in Fitzgerald's Park on Saturday morning. The museum in Cork are having an exhibition. And then there's a private family event in the barracks. And that's followed in the evening by a dinner. And then on Sunday, there's Béal na Bláth, plus in the Imperial Hotel then, there's going to be the screening of a few new documentaries on Michael Collins, which I haven't seen. I'm looking forward to seeing them. And on Monday morning, just a small group of us are going to sit down and have breakfast. And we're also going to unveil a new portrait of Michael Collins in the foyer of the hotel. And that's basically it. I think some people might go out to Béal na Bláth again. On the Monday,
are there some speeches on the Monday night? Is there some?
Yeah, that's right. There's a gentleman by the name, a relative of mine, Paul Amoracu, is actually going to give just a history of the events around that day.
Because I'm going to speak with someone on my drive show that evening around that as well. So a whole series of events. Will you at any point go up to Glasnevin? Does that mean anything to the fact that he's buried there? Or is that a spot for pilgrimage?
Well, I know that there... Glasnevin is a fascinating place.
Isn't
to go.
It? Yeah.
Because I know that there's there's a French woman constantly renewing the flowers there on the grave all the time. There was an event in Glasnevin last weekend, but I was busy. My son was getting married in a place called Marienthal, which is outside of Strasbourg, so that kept me busy. So my priorities weren't last weekend were
yes familial. Well, they were familial and familial,
yeah,
but closer exactly. and Well, congratulations. I hope
Thank
that
you.
Was a lovely event.
It was, yeah.
But yeah, Glasnevin is a fascinating place to go to, and there's some great tours you can take around there, and there's O'Connell's Memorial, which is this massive round tower that you climb up to the top and have amazing views. And I think it was O'Connell bequeathed it to the Catholics of Dublin, who at that time had nowhere to be buried.
Yeah.
And it's now... it's a huge graveyard, and there's a lovely walk around, and you've got the botanical gardens just beyond it. Highly recommend if anyone listening has not been to Glasnevin for a wander around the.
Yeah, and his grave stands out within the grave, it's quite poignant when you go and see his grave there, you know.
So, at what age do you recall an awareness of your famous relative, and what were your feelings around that, and did it inspire you to learn more, or was it?
Yeah, I suppose I was about 10 or 12 when I realised, or maybe 10, 9 or 10, because I remember we used to collect my great aunt Hannah, who lived in Monkstown, and we would bring her out to Béal na Bláth, and I used to wonder what it was all about, you know.
And she'd actually go out to the site of where he was.
She would bring her out at the commemoration on around the 22nd of August.
Yes, yes.
And I just got interested in history then.
And Hannah would have been his sister.
The elder sister he lived with when he was in.
Of course,
he was in London.
They wouldn't have said anything, would they? Or, you know, would you?
I suppose there was a lot of pain.
Yeah.
After he was shot. And they said very little. Mm. Even my own mother, who was his niece, and my uncles, they spoke very little to us about those times. They were sad times for everybody.
Mm. And when the family meet, are there differing views? Are there, you know, vigorous debates in any way? Or is it...
No,
I mean,
the
story is clear in many respects.
Yeah, they were just, I think, there's a lot of sadness at the end of the day that he was shot.
Yeah.
A very young man and...
What more could he have done for Ireland?
Yeah, I suppose. What did it achieve?
Mm.
And nobody, you know, a lot of people say he did it, but what did it achieve at the end of the day? Mm. I think, in my own view, it just created a greater wedge between different factions in this country.
Mm. Mm. Yes, absolutely. It's It's a strange one to try to tussle with the concept of the Civil War. You know, the four courts had been occupied for a period of 6 months in a kind of a loose way.
Yeah.
And then there was these two sort of, it's hard to know if they were even connected to the IRA, two Irish nationalists of Irish heritage, but born in England, who assassinated Sir Henry Wilson in London, and caused the British government. And he'd been a key figure in lots of respects, and admired and respected over there, and a huge unionist, and very anti any kind of independence for Ireland. But his assassination caused the British government to say to the Free State government, because they hadn't left, they said, if you guys don't sort out what's going on here, we're not going, and we'll sort it out. And it forced the Collinses and the others to take up arms against their own, and like I said earlier, it must have broken their hearts to do it, and to see
but
that
I think,
sort of strife.
You know, when, you know, a few 6 months earlier, Michael Collins said when he signed the treaty, he had signed his own death warrant. So he seemed to have a good idea of what it would mean for many people in Ireland. I think what people forget today is communications and you know what people. People could say what they wanted to say, and people believed, as I said earlier in this interview, what they wanted to believe. You know, so that's all part of it, and it's all so sad, you know.
Do you believe he's been commemorated sufficiently within Ireland?
I think that in recent years, people realised that Michael Collins existed. I think in the earlier generations, in my generation, and generations before it, there was very little written about him.
Did the film change much?
I think it probably did, yeah. I think it changes people's attitude. I asked an aunt, my own mother, my father died 43 years ago, but my mother died about, I think, 2 years before it was released. But I went to it with an aunt of mine, and I asked her, what did you think of it? And Jim Sheridan won't appreciate it, but my aunt said, they never used that language in those times. But she said the violence was a lot worse.
Yeah.
And I found that quite frightening, because parts of the Michael Collins movie was really quite violent.
Now, you live in interesting times, I think, as a Chinese. I don't know, is it a blessing or is it a warning? But certainly they lived in interesting times. There's no question about it. Aidan O'Sullivan, you are the grandnephew of Michael Collins, and we've spoken about him here today, and I'm very grateful. And I hope the commemorations on the 100th anniversary of the Béal na Bláth ambush that saw him pass all too soon all go well, and that you as a family get to mark him and remember him and continue to be proud of him on into the future.
Thanks, Dave. Thank you.
For more Red FM podcasts, go to redfm.ie/podcasts.